So my topic is Be Men. And this is actually an exposition of just one word that appears in the Greek New Testament in 1 Corinthians chapter 16 and verse 13. In the King James Version, that statement reads, "Quit you like men." But it actually is just one word in Greek. It is the Greek word for man that has a second person plural verb imperative ending on it, which is probably meaningless to most of you, but it essentially says this. It's impossible to do it with one word in English, but about the closest we can come to it in English is, "Y'all be men." So it's you plural. It's not thou. It's y'all. Y'all be men. And so I think that this is primarily an opportunity for me to do some of what Israel Wayne was talking about in the previous session, and that is to affirm ideas that you already have. Sometimes a modern translation will just pick a characteristic of what the translator believes to be manliness and will translate it something like "be courageous." But I think that there is a lot of content in the fact that it actually says "be men." And it is assumed that we know what a man is and how he behaves. So it's just implied. It is implied that we will know how to act like men. It's interesting. I'm going through the Robert Murray McShane plan of Bible reading this year, and so my first Old Testament reading is in the book of Leviticus, and I've just finished three chapters in the book of Leviticus that have to do with how to determine whether or not someone has leprosy, or whether or not a cloth has leprosy, or whether or not a house has leprosy. And it strikes me that there is more overt, explicit teaching in the Bible about how to determine whether or not someone has leprosy, something that, in a practical sense, is totally irrelevant to my life. But here are three long chapters on how to determine whether or not someone has leprosy. And all of the teaching that the Bible, all of the explicit teaching that the Bible gives on how to have a godly marriage could fit on half a page. And then I might make a similar observation with all the explicit teaching that the Bible has on how to behave like a man could probably fit on less than half a page. It's almost all implicit teaching. So once the New Testament says, regarding marriage, "Husbands, love your wives, just as Christ loved the church," that opens up a whole realm of instruction. We see how Christ loved the church, and then we're able to apply those principles to our marriages. "Wives, submit to your husbands as unto the Lord." That opens up a whole realm of implicit teaching on how this is to be done. And I think that the same thing can be said with manliness and masculinity as it's revealed in the scripture. There's very little explicit teaching. Here's what a man does. But as we read about examples, we read stories about men in the Bible who were clearly admired as godly men, and we see what are some of the characteristics that these men demonstrated. Oh, that must be what it means to be a godly man. Then there's a whole lot of teaching on be men. But I do find it interesting that the Apostle Paul here in 1 Corinthians chapter 16 can just trust, you know what it's like to act like a man. And so, all of y'all, all you men, act like men. It's assumed that we know what a man is and how he behaves. Nature does. There are a couple of instances in the Bible where the argument is made this way. Does not even nature teach you something? So nature is a legitimate source of obtaining truth. And There are places where the Bible is not explicit on particular aspects of manhood, and that you can look and say, well, does not even nature teach you some important aspects of what it means to be a man? So as I'm looking around at this congregation, fully half the people in here are females. And so this is not an exhortation for you to be men, but this is an opportunity for you to become equipped to recognize masculinity. Look for that in a potential mate. Or if you're already married, to see how that your husband is demonstrating this and put into practice some of that positive affirmation that Israel Wayne was talking about. I'm glad that you take this responsibility, and it really means a lot to our family. That can mean so much when something like that is coming from a wife. So there are things that even nature teaches you about how a man ought to behave and how a woman ought to behave. And most people recognize that. I still believe that. I think that there is an enormous amount of pressure that is being exerted on what we know to be natural. There's a lot of pressure from the world, the flesh, and the devil to say some of these ideas that people have held about manhood for millennia are ideas that really are misogynistic, that is, they're hateful towards women, or they're detrimental to society. The previous six centuries, previous six millennia that we have of recorded history, all of those people were wrong about how a man should behave and how a woman should behave and how sexuality works. And here's how it really should work. It's an incredibly arrogant position. Scott Brown gave a talk about how that the two primary ways that God spreads the gospel and converts people is, the two primary ways are through the family and through the church. And so if we have a spiritual foe, and that spiritual foe has any intelligence about him and those over whom he has influence, then I would think that that spiritual foe would have enough sense to attack these two primary ways that God is influencing the world for Christ and extending the kingdom of Christ. Satan and his forces do not want to see the kingdom of Christ extended. And so if they have any strategic possibility at all, any logical strategic capabilities at all, then it makes sense that they would direct their efforts towards undermining the foundations that underpin the family and underpin the church. And of course, at the basis of family is the distinction that God has made between men and women and how they come together and what they do when they come together and how they are to rear their families. Some of you are old enough to remember when the great basketball player David Robinson was in college at Navy. It was about 40 years ago. But, I think David Robinson, for those of you who don't know who he is, he grew to be about 6'11", and at that time the Navy, I think, had a limit on how tall they would allow people to come into the Naval Academy, maybe 6'5 or 6'6". And so when David Robinson entered the Naval Academy, he was under the limit, but then he grew. After he was 18, he grows up to be 6'11", and he has incredible skill as a basketball player. And Navy is not known for their basketball teams, but here they have got David Robinson, one of the greatest players in the world, who is on their team. And so if you were playing Navy and you wanted to win, then it really made sense that you would direct your efforts to shutting down David Robinson, because nobody else is really going to do that much damage. It's David Robinson that you need to concentrate on. And I remember watching a game on television when the Navy players were not passing it to David Robinson every time. And the commentators were saying, this is ridiculous. They have got a guy on their team who is all world, and they're playing as if he's not on their team. And so let's look at that strategy. When the devil looks at Team Jesus and he sees who are the stars on this team, he sees, well, it's the family led by men, and it's the churches also led by men. Let's focus our attention on these guys. Everything else that's going on, all the various parachurch organizations, yeah, they've got some skill. They're good enough to be on the team, but they're really not going to do so much damage as the David Robinsons on this team. And so let's focus our attention. On the other hand, those of us who are on the good guys team, let's focus on the great players that we have, strengthening families, strengthening churches. So it makes sense from a battle perspective that a crafty foe would aim his arrows and his gunshots at undermining the family and undermining leadership in the church by attacking what people for millennia have known to be true about men. Not just Christians, not just religious people, but the whole world has pretty much been in agreement about how a man should behave. And most people have realized that, although they feel increasingly embarrassed about holding so firmly to these ideas that are now being foisted as being old-fashioned, out-of-date ideas. So I hope that this talk today will help to encourage you and say, no, these gut feelings that you have, not just as a Christian, but also just as a human being who observes things, these gut feelings, many of them are right. It does not even nature itself. It teaches you what a man ought to act like. It's interesting that the homosexuals seem to know about the distinction between men and women, masculine and feminine. Because in lesbian relationships and also in perverted relationships that involve men, there is almost always an effort to reproduce male and female. So there will almost always be a partner who acts like a man or tries to act like a man, and there will be a partner who acts like a female or tries to act like a female. That's true, as far as I can tell, of virtually all homosexual relationships. A lot of people don't realize that even the Bible, when it's saying that there are certain people who will not enter the kingdom of heaven, it specifies both parts of that relationship. So in some modern translations, it's almost impossible to recognize it if you only read the English Bible. But in the Greek, it's the person who is acting like a man in a homosexual relationship will not enter the kingdom of heaven. And the person who is acting like a female in a homosexual relationship will not enter the kingdom of heaven. And so even homosexuals who are not trying to obey God recognize there's a difference between men and women. When I was teaching on the collegiate level, I've already told you I was mostly teaching people who were preparing for ministry. But I surmise that a little experiment that I did with my classes would work in a non-religious setting if you could get people to let down their guard and answer honestly. And here's a little exercise that I would lead my classes through. And this would come up, especially when we were reading John Milton's Paradise Lost, which very beautifully talks about the differences between men and women. But some of the things that Milton says about women would be offensive even to Christian women. It became increasingly so. I started teaching at the college in 2002, and my last year was 2020. I could tell a real difference in the attitudes of the men and women who were at this Christian college during those 18 years. They became more obviously under the influence of worldly ways of thinking about men and women. And so especially some of the women would be offended at some of the things that John Milton said about women's giftedness and what they were not well equipped to do. And so I would perform this little exercise with them. I would draw a line down the middle of the board. On one side of the board, on the left side, I would say men. And I would say, now I would like to ask you to offer answers to the question, what are most men gifted to do better than most women? So what are gifts that most men have that most women don't? Or characteristic, what are characteristics that most men have that most women don't? And then on the right side of the line on the board, I would say, what are characteristics that most women have that most men don't? And so, class would eagerly participate in that exercise. And so almost the first thing on the men's side would be, men are stronger than women. Yeah, occasionally you can find exceptions to that. You know, a woman who really milks a cow a whole lot might have a better grip than a man who never milks a cow. But in most cases, a man's going to be stronger than a woman. And so, that goes on the man's side. Men are strong. And then women are more concerned about relationships. Men are more competitive. Women are more concerned about making a house. So in no particular order, we would list maybe 8 or 10 things. And then once the list was completed and we were finished taking answers, I would say, now if you were the CEO of the human race and you were trying to look at the workforce that you had and you were trying to determine how your workforce can be used most effectively, what would you have a person with this skill set doing and what would you have a person with this skill set doing? Pointing to first the man and then the woman. And the answer was just clear. I mean, the giftings and characteristics that most men have, that most women don't have, equips them to be protectors, providers, leaders. The gifts that most women have, that most men don't have, equips them to be homemakers, nurturers. And it was just so obvious. I think that some of the students were surprised that it was so clear. And like I said, I think that if you could sneak that test, that exercise, onto an unsuspecting secular audience, they would come up with very similar lists if they were being honest. Now, the rest of my time, I'm going to devote to two headings. So the first one is manhood under attack, and the second heading is manhood under God. So in this first section, I'm going to look at what are some ways that the enemy is attacking manhood, and so we'll look at some of the main weapons very quickly. Secondly, what are some of the primary strategies as manhood is under attack? Weapons, strategies, and then thirdly, the strange compliance that many Christian men have with these nefarious weapons and strategies. So, manhood under attack, what are the weapons? And I'm going to mention three. They all three start with the letter E. So, one weapon that the enemy is using to attack manhood is education. So, by this, I don't mean just the setting of education, whether you're in a classroom, at a Christian school, or classroom at a public school. I mean the content of what is being, the content of the education is an enemy that is a weapon that the enemy is using to say that there really are no differences between men and women other than biological differences, and even those differences can be surgically taken care of. So that is an educational thrust, and I am not in touch that much with what's going on the media and so on. But you've got to be living in a hole not to know that there is a massive push of information that is saying there is really no great difference between men and women. This crept in even into the Christian context in which I taught. So sometimes these students would raise objections to my insisting that there were such drastic differences between men and women, and that it was evidenced in a variety of ways. And I would ask the questions like this. So why is it that when you go into an art museum, Occasionally you'll find a Mary Cassatt or someone like that, but for the most part, 95% of the great paintings that are recognized as great paintings and great sculptures have been done by men. Why is that? Or why is it that you might listen to classical music radio all day long, and you may hear one female composer? Probably not. Why is it that there are no great women among the great composers? I said these are tasks that don't really require strength, so you can't say that that's the difference. We understand why there are no women who are great NFL players. We understand why there are no women who are heavyweight champions of the world in boxing. But here, or let's go into areas where women usually excel. Why is it that virtually all of the great chefs of the world are men? Why is that? And the objection would be raised, well, that's because men have historically controlled these things. And so even if there was a woman who had great talent as a composer or great talent as an artist, she wouldn't have the opportunity to do it. It's okay, that could be a valid point. But let's take something that is of relatively recent origin and that doesn't require strength. Why is it that there are virtually no women who are violent criminals? I mean, there are women who are criminals, but they're probably over 95% of the violent crime is committed by men. Why do you explain that? If we're all just the same, why is that? Or let's take video gaming for an example. So are any of you guys video gamers, I would ask? Oh, yeah, you know, there's always video gamers. I said, are there any women among the great video gamers that are competing in the world? I said, what? No. Why is that? Well, it's because men are mean to women when they get into video gaming. I said, don't you think men are ever mean to men, call men bad names when they get into video gaming? And so at this time, you know, the feminists in the room are getting mad at me. They're going to go tell on me to the dean. He's going to call me in and rebuke me. This guy that was starting kindergarten when I was teaching college for my fifth year is going to rebuke me for how, oh, girls are uncomfortable in your class. Which he said to me one time. I said, men are uncomfortable in my class. He said, well, Dr. Oreck, why do you think that is? I said, it's because they've never been around a man in their whole life. Why, thank you. Thank you very much. I did get fired over that kind of stuff, so. But the Lord is good. Whatever their intentions were, the Lord meant it for good. But why is that? And I'd say, okay, let's just consider this as a possibility. There are no great women among the great composers of the world because women historically have had something more important to do, more important thing to do than sit around composing music. Let's consider the possibility that there are very few painters among the great artists of the world who are women because women have had something more important to do. And then, you know, they kind of roll their eyes and say, oh, thanks a lot for giving us childbearing. I say, if that's your attitude, you have been brainwashed by the world. The hand that rocks the cradle is the hand that rules the world. And there is no job that is more important than the job that has historically been entrusted almost exclusively to women of rearing children. But that idea that education has said we're all essentially the same except for the strictures that have been placed on us by society, that is very powerful. And it's very powerful even among the cream of the crop of Christian students who show up at a Christian school with a good reputation. So education is being used by the enemy, and then a second E, entertainment is being used by the enemy. So the entertainment, which would include television shows, movies, the things that get popular on the internet. For about 14 years, I have met with a group of godly young men. They're now in their late 30s and early 40s. Some of them I have discipled for more than 20 years. But I get together with them once a year at a cabin in eastern Kentucky, and we shoot guns and we do fun, manly things. And I also assign them a book that they are to read. It's usually a book that they would never choose to read on their own, but I'll say, here's a book, and we're going to discuss it when we get together. So year before last, as we were winding down, this group of very godly men, manly men, we were sitting around the table, and they said, is there something that you see in us that we need to be corrected for? And I said, well, since you asked, yes, there is. Anytime one of you mentions a particular video that you've seen on YouTube, all the rest of you chime in eagerly and say, oh, yeah, we've watched that. That is so cool. My kids can say that word for word. I've also noticed that anytime someone among you mentions an episode from The Office or from Seinfeld, every single one of you has seen that episode. And I said, I just don't see how you can have that kind of familiarity with these things without having spent many, many hours watching them. And so I suspect that you are not using your time as wisely as you might. You know, the thing that you do crowds out the thing that you might have done. And that's true for better, that's true for worse. Thing that you do crowds out the thing that you might have done. It's not just people who are wasting their time watching Seinfeld and reruns of The Office and whatever else. It's not just that. It's that sometimes people, even who are theologically minded, end up spending all their time reading theology blogs and just always on the internet looking at this and that. And I just wonder, how do you guys do that? It just takes so much time for me to read the Bible. It just takes so much time for me to meditate. It just takes so much time for me to pray. It takes so much time for me to have meaningful face-to-face relationships. How do you guys have time to engage in all these theological fusses that you're constantly in? There's a young lady affiliated with our church who is a talented painter, and I'm just on the cusp of asking her to paint a painting for me. And I'm going to tell her, here's what I'd like you to paint. In the background, I would like for you to depict the ark under construction. And in the foreground, I would like for you to have some guys who are dressed in theological regalia who are sailing toy sailboats on a small mud puddle. Now, to me, that would be a very pregnant picture and would just depict what I think so much of this internet fuss is. You're just obsessed with minutiae. And at the end of your life, you may escape without having dived headfirst into an ocean of some kind of social scandal that makes everybody question your salvation. But what's going to happen with most of you is that you just have slowly dissolved in mud puddles of mediocrity. When you might have been a man, you might have really meant something to the people around you if you just stop whittling away your life in this mindless, meaningless entertainment. Well, the enemy's using it. And then a third weapon that the enemy is using is not just education, not just entertainment, but the enemy is using effeminate Christianity. Oh, my goodness. Just so many sissies. just so many sissies in positions of leadership. Men who are constantly licking their finger to see which way is the wind of public opinion blowing. I am at this conference largely because of an interview, a panel discussion that the head of our men's ministry, who's here, Dallas Constant, conducted with me and another man in the church. I don't remember what the question was. It was something along the lines of the differences between men and women. And I gave an answer that immediately raised a response. Within a few hours, there was a very tactful critic who, in a very gentle, sane way, said, I don't think that what Dr. Oreck said was helpful. In fact, under these circumstances, I think it will be very harmful. I don't know if there was pressure to take the video down. I can't remember all the details, but Dallas did forward to me this very tactful criticism. It was not mean-spirited, but it was, this is destructive teaching. And then within a few hours, I get an email from Christy Wilbanks who says, I saw your video on manhood and womanhood. I showed that to my kids. I showed it to Wade. I want you to come and speak at our conference. So just those kind of differences. There was another woman who Dallas showed the video to or had seen the video. And this woman said, I want to go to church where that man is the pastor. What I'm saying is there will be some people who will hate you. Some will hate you. Some will love you. Some will flatter. Some will slight. Cease from man and look above you. Trust in God and do the right. And I think that there are a lot of people who are sick of all these spineless, sissified men who have positions of leadership in churches and positions of leadership that they get asked to speak at a lot of different conferences. And people are just saying, I just wish that somebody would stand up on his hind legs and speak the truth. And some people will hate you for it. There are others who will say, where has this kind of talk been my whole life? But the enemy doesn't want that kind of leadership. The enemy doesn't want those kind of men leading families and those kind of men leading churches. Those who are attacking manhood have strategies. Let me go over several of them with you. So we've done the weapons. So education, entertainment, and effeminate Christianity. Now, what are some of the weapons, the strategies that they use? One strategy is remove boys from the presence of men and expect them to act like girls. Remove boys from the presence of men. I was pastor of a church in the hills of West Virginia for 7 years, and when I went there, there was only one young man in the church. He was about 12. And so we didn't have a youth group. There was one boy and there was one girl. They were both about 12 years old. And during the years that I was there, I would just spend time with those two young people. And so by the time I left, they were 18, so I've got my math a little bit wrong. They were about 11 when I went there. But they had both graduated high school when I left. And the boy, his dad would just bring him to all the stuff that the men did. The girl was helping with the women's things, and she was just always hanging around. And both of those young people are leaders in that church now. I've been gone from that church for almost 30 years, but both of those young people are now adults and they're leaders in that church. But I just admired that father, that he knew the importance of having his 11-year-old boy. When there's a work day at church, he would bring his boy. If there's some kind of job that the men are doing, he brings his boy. In discussing one of the books that I would have the students read, Homer's Odyssey, there is a young man in the book, Telemachus, who becomes a man by the end of the book. And it is true what Kevin Swanson said, that Augustine found great fault with the classics. And obviously, I don't entirely agree with Augustine. I think that they can be judiciously taught. And one of the things that I think is taught in Homer is some of the factors that help a boy become a man. But when I was teaching that, I would say, what are some of the factors that help a boy to become a man? And the students were very insightful. Well, a boy is more likely to become a man if he is around men and he sees how men behave. A boy is more likely to become a man when he is given meaningful responsibility, and so on. And so the enemy knows about that. And so if he can find strategies to keep dads distracted and keep boys away from dads and away from men, then that is an effective strategy. Find ways, men, that you can have your boys around you. Another strategy is to remove boys from the real world of work and mud and woods and put them in front of video games all the time, an unreal world. Several years ago, my wife and I were discussing how lost kids are when it comes to reading poetry. And my wife said, well, Jim, they've never had any formal instruction in poetry. I said, King David never had any formal instruction in poetry. The problem is not these kids haven't sat in a classroom where poems were being read. The problem is these kids have never waded the creeks, and they haven't been out into the world where most of the metaphors of poetry are taken from. A third strategy of the enemy is to portray masculine men in a bad light, make fathers look like idiots. Last time I checked, that was a pretty common motif of entertainment. Make men look like idiots. One of the favorite ploys of Disney is to make someone who is a hunter look like a mindless idiot. Number four, I'm talking about strategies. Flood the world with pornography, one of the enemy's most effective, because how this erodes the foundationals of manhood is that it gives young men and people who are looking at porn, it gives the impression that you can have sex without responsibility. And that's one of the most wicked things about pornography. Another strategy of the enemy is idolize feminine characteristics to the exclusion of masculine ones. So in the list that I'm just about to give to you, there are good things that need to be balanced by other good things. And when these good things are in exclusion, they become dangerous and become effeminizing. So, for example, the first one is when you teach gentleness without teaching courage. They need to go together. Gentleness along with courage. Oh, you're supposed to be understanding. But you never confront anyone. And the two things need to go together. Gentleness, yes. Or sensitivity without conviction. This leads you to say that you can just tolerate everything. Absolute toleration is only possible if you're convinced that nothing is true. So it's good that we teach our boys to be sensitive, but we also teach them there are certain barriers that you will not cross. You're going to have conviction. There are true things. Truth is truth if nobody believes it. And you hold on to what is true. Have conviction. It's important that we have emotion and that we allow our young men to have and express emotion. But emotion without logic just becomes flimsy. It becomes nonsense. You cannot simply say, we believe the woman. There has to be an examination of the evidence before you just say, I'm going to believe the woman. I think that there are too many men who persistently and voluntarily submit themselves and their families to this endless attack against manhood. The attack of entertainment and education and effeminate Christianity. We men who allow this to continue to go on are like a battered wife who stays in an abusive relationship for bad reasons. We have alternatives to liberal education. We have alternatives to liberal entertainment. We have alternatives to sissified, effeminate Christian teaching. Many of you are familiar with The Lord of the Rings, and you remember that Theoden, who was the king of the Riders of Rohan, was under the influence of a bad man named Grima, or Wormtongue. And Grima and Wormtongue were just constantly whispering bad information into the ears of Theoden. And he felt like he was just a helpless old man. And that's the way that men might feel, as with the Grima and the Wormtongue of bad, devilish entertainment and education and effeminate Christianity keep whispering into our ears, oh, you mustn't be a man. But manhood under God is something different than that. Manhood under God. God created man male and women female. Let the differences be obvious and celebrated. Walk like a man. You know, I think I can tell from 200, 300 yards away whether the person walking on the sidewalk in front of me is a man or a woman. Not just by their shape, by the way that they walk. And sometimes I'm fooled, and it's a woman who's walking like a man, or a man who's walking like a woman. Homosexuals are able to pick up on this because they imitate effeminate ways when they want to. They imitate effeminate ways of walking. They imitate effeminate gestures. And you know, I just do a few of those things, and you say, "Wow, that really doesn't look like Dr. O." It's just, but you know, people pick up on that. Talk like a man. Learn how to speak well. Learn how to speak effectively. Organize your thoughts. Talk like a man. There's such a thing as muscular prose. You ever read that phrase? Muscular prose. That's someone who knows what needs to be said and says it in a way that can be understood. Play like a man. Work like a man. Follow God like a man. You know, the straw man portrayal that the world gives of masculinity has elements of truth in it, and the world hates that. The straw man is that, well, what we're talking about in patriarchy is a domineering husband. The truth in that the world hates is that a man is a husband who leads. The world says, oh, you know, a masculine man, he's always watching football. The truth in that is that men are attracted to the idea of striving together with a goal that is difficult to reach with other men. And the world wants to turn that away. Oh, you know, the world says, you Christians, you want to say the masculine man, he's always hunting and killing animals. And the truth in that is a person who is a serious, conscientious hunter and killing animals is taking dominion over the world. And the enemy is attacking that. Oh, you Christians, you always say that masculine men are guys who are playing with guns and shooting guns. Well, the truth in that they hate is that a godly man recognizes that he has a responsibility to use tools to protect his family and to provide for his family. And the world says, oh, there's mansplaining. Guys are just going on and on explaining things to women. And what the world hates in that is that you need to teach your wife and your family, and the world hates that. And the straw man is, oh, you know, masculine man, hairy, ill-dressed caveman. And the truth that is in that is, don't dress like a sissy. Don't dress like a fop. Let it be obvious from 200 yards away that you're a man and not a woman. You need to be a man in your private life. You need to be a man in your family. You need to be a man in the church. You need to be a man in your private life as you soak in the Bible. And the God who made you a man teaches you what it's like to be a man in the various spheres of responsibility that you have. Respect your body. Don't let your body get into the condition that you look like a woman because you can't control how much fat and sugar you eat and you can't get yourself outdoors to exercise. You ought to look like a man. Respect your mind. Don't settle for just coasting along and never reading hard books, never learning new skills. Master a manly skill. Learn to do a trade, boys. Learn to play a sport well. Learn how to start a fire without using a match. Learn how to skin an animal and make soap from his guts. Learn how to hunt. Learn how to shoot. Learn manly stuff. You know, Kirk has told us a couple times this week that sometimes these boys show up at the homeschool conferences with a machete that hangs down to their legs. And he rightly says that's not what masculinity is all about. But Kirk would agree with me. That's part of what masculinity is about. You don't see girls coming that way, do you? But to say, son, you know, if there's a shooter that comes in here, I hope you'll get that knife out. Stab him right quick. I think that's kind of positive encouragement. That may not be. We might need to run that past a first responder on whether or not that's good advice. But you get the idea. Kurt was talking about the words might not be right, but you see my heart. Encourage that boy. When he's acting like a man, encourage him in acting like a man. In the family, exercise leadership. If you're a son, you're not the dad yet, learn how to be a leader. Love your wife. You are her head. Teach your family. You are their authority. Provide and protect. And then in the church, be a man. Pastors and preachers must be men. It's unnatural for a woman to do it. Someone once asked the famous literary critic Samuel Johnson, "Can a woman preach?" And he said, "Sir, a woman might preach. You might teach a dog to walk on his hind legs, but it's not natural." It's not natural that women should be in a position where they are speaking authoritatively to men. Leadership is restricted to men. Men, let's step up and take it. Rise up, O men of God. Have done with lesser things. Give heart and soul and mind and strength to serve the King of Kings. Rise up, O men of God. The church for you doth wait. Sent forth to serve the needs of man, in Christ our strength is great. Lift high the cross of Christ. Tread where his feet have trod. As brothers of the Son of Man, rise up, O men of God.